this is the expediting of environmental reviews and approvals for high-priority infrastructure projects.
Overshadowed by a contentious press conference, how a new Trump executive order could affect an Alaska gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 18th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, protesters in Fairbanks rally to protect a particular predator.
So it's just wasting animals, wasting life, and wasting money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The state's largest wolf control program was the target of a protest outside Alaska Department of Fish and Game Fairbanks headquarters yesterday. Protesters, organized by Alaskans for Wildlife, want Fish and Game to immediately halt the long-running aerial wolf kill in the 40-mile river region east of Fairbanks. KOEC's Dan Bross reports.
A group of about 50 protesters howled and chanted outside the Fish and Game office, expressing dismay with the annual 40-mile aerial wolf kill. The winter spring wolf hunt is aimed at growing the 40-mile caribou herd, but recent Fish and Game research shows it hasn't worked. The state plans to suspend the program next spring, not soon enough for protester and hunter Frank Maxwell.
Limitations on the caribou populations are not due to wolves or predation. It's due to nutritional stress, as their studies have said. So it's just wasting animals, wasting life, and wasting money.
Over 1,000 wolves have been shot from aircraft in the state program since 2004, with the harvest ramping up in recent years. Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Darren Bruning says despite indications that habitat is limiting caribou herd growth, the state will continue the wolf kill another year for research reasons.
Having 7 years of high-intensity removal data to compare to the previous 7 years of low-intensity removal data is the most consistent, reasonable, and responsible approach.
Bruning maintains the comparison data is important to all interests,
including the International 40-Mile Harvest Management Coalition and those who do not support predation control or are unsure about its benefit.
Bruning says the program will halt in the spring of 2018, after which biologists will see how the caribou fare without wolf control. Protester Sean McGuire with Alaskans for Wildlife says continuing the wolf kill for another season just for science is wrong.
I mean, these wolves are very intelligent, highly social creatures. To run an experiment on them when it's not even going to help the caribou herd, that is really outrageous.
McGuire adds that the predator control program costs Fish and Game over $37,000 per wolf harvested, spending the cash-strapped state can't afford. The state's Bruning emphasizes that the 40-mile area wolf kill will only be temporarily halted next spring. He could not say when it would resume. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Anchorage police are searching for five people involved in an assault and kidnapping in East Anchorage. Police say the suspect abducted and beat 24-year-old Abshir Muhammad on Sunday. They allegedly put him in a dog kennel, where he was discovered and driven to the hospital by a person who was not believed to be involved with the assault. As of today, according to APD, Muhammad is still in critical condition. Police spokesperson MJ Tim says evidence suggests the assault was not random, but they don't yet know why it happened.
We have a bunch of theories, and that's what we're trying to determine exactly which one is the correct one in terms of what happened and why.
Officers are searching for four alleged assault suspects, as well as a fifth unnamed person of interest. APD says all five should be considered armed and dangerous. On Tuesday, President Trump signed an executive order to speed up environmental reviews of infrastructure projects. His announcement of it in the lobby of Trump Tower was somewhat overshadowed by what he said next about the white nationalist march in Virginia. But Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin took a look at that order to figure out what it might mean.
Developers, and especially in Alaska, the oil industry, often argue environmental regulation is too burdensome, that it can take years to get a permit. Trump says his order takes care of that. It's called Establishing Discipline and Accountability in the Environmental Review and Permitting Process for Infrastructure. The president held up a flowchart for a hypothetical highway permit application to illustrate what he says will be the results.
This is what we will bring it down to. This is less than 2 years. This is going to happen quickly. That's what I'm signing today.
No, President Trump is not the first to think of this idea.
Georgetown Law Professor William Busby says previous presidents and Congress have taken cracks at streamlining environmental review. President George W. Bush signed an order to expedite the process. President Obama signed an order and a law that sets deadlines for permitting decisions. This wasn't even the first streamlining bill for President Trump. Here he is at a signing ceremony at the Oval Office in January.
This is the expediting of environmental reviews and approvals for high-priority infrastructure projects. We intend to fix our country.
That order was shorter and not as specific as the one he announced at Trump Tower. Professor Busby says a president can speed things up. He sets priorities and tells agencies what their focus should be.
So that a president can do, you know, kind of instructing people on how they should think about their time. On the other hand, there is a lot of law that influences this.
Laws like the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, and regulations on wetlands. They obligate agencies to do things a certain way. Busby says an executive order can't nullify regulations, and changing them, that takes time. For permit applicants, time is money. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation issued a press release celebrating President Trump's order. AGDC is the state corporation that's applied to build an 800-mile LNG pipeline from the North Slope. Rosetta Alcantara is the company's vice president of communications.
You know, across the board, I think this has a lot of really good impacts for infrastructure projects nationwide.
The corporation submitted some 60,000 pages to support its permit application. The environmental review has begun. Skeptics say a final decision could be years away. But Alcantara says AGDC hopes to get its permit in 2018.
Although we don't know what the immediate impacts of this executive order is going to be on our particular project, and the permitting process is, you know, it's uncertain, we believe the guidance provided by the White House to federal agencies to expedite major projects will be positive overall.
AGDC just got word that the government will fast-track its application using the process set up by the law Congress passed during the Obama administration. The environmental review, though, isn't what's holding up the project. The gas line needs financing. Governor Bill Walker asked President Trump to include loan guarantees for it as part of his $1 trillion infrastructure initiative. But that initiative may have suffered a setback this week. The White House abruptly canceled plans for an Infrastructure Advisory Council and dissolved two other business-related panels after a stream of CEOs resigned from them. They were protesting Trump's incendiary statements on the violence in Charlottesville. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska Airlines pilots have reached a breaking point in negotiations with the company and now have plans to picket outside Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. Their union, the largest in North America, says that the pilots are not being compensated as well as their peers at other successful airline companies. Alaska Airlines says its pilots will be getting a significant wage increase, but the company is trying to stay competitive and offer the lowest fares possible. But the union isn't buying that argument. Jen Sutton is a spokesperson for the Alaska Master Executive Council of the Airline Pilots Association, which represents more than 2,500 Alaska and Virgin America pilots.
It's Alaska management has continued to insist that the pilots should be willing to accept a contract below market rates.
The negotiations have been ongoing since Alaska and Virgin America began merging last year. Sutton says the Alaska and Virgin pilots want better pay, better retirement, and better job security.
They see what the other pilot contracts are, and they work for a successful, highly respected airline. And it's really kind of baffling for our pilots as to why they should not have a contract that reflects the market.
The pilots plan to picket outside the airport in Anchorage on Monday. Sutton says the airport security regulations will limit the protests to a couple dozen at a time, and pilots will be rotating in, some coming straight off their shifts from the plane to picketing. Alaska Airline spokeswoman Marilyn Romano says the airline is hoping to reach a conclusion to the negotiations through arbitration, but she refused to answer any questions not addressed in a two-sentence statement from Alaska Airlines.
The picketing on Monday will not interfere with our operations, and we don't anticipate any related interruptions to passenger service on Monday.
The protest is set to start at 1 p.m. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, is dip netting in South Central Alaska a solution to food insecurity and hunger?
There was winters where I had nothing but fish and potatoes and rice, and that was literally all that we ate all winter long, every meal.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
After 8 hours yesterday, no real solutions surfaced at the National Transportation Safety Board hearing to curb Alaska's rash of fatal airplane crashes. KYUK's Joanna Urich reports.
The fatal Raven air crash near Togiak last fall was the focus of the investigative hearing. Sitting in the audience was Raven's new CEO, Dave Flieger.
My focus has been and always will be on safety, and this is now my fourth airline as a CEO. And it's the very first thing I do is focus on safety when I get in a company.
The changes Haglund Aviation Services has put into effect since last fall's crash of the Raven Connect plane it operated appeared to be well received by members of the National Transportation Safety Board and its inquiry committee. But it's clear there'll be additional recommendations when the investigation is completed. The NTSB wants its report to help build a case to improve Alaska's aviation infrastructure, to bring it closer to the kind of weather services and instrument flying capacities found in the lower 48. In Anchorage, I'm Johanna Urich.
The U.S. Department of Labor says the Alaska Marine Highway System is violating federal leave laws. A civil suit filed in the U.S. District Court alleges the ferry system miscalculates time off mandated by the Family Medical Leave Act, a claim which state officials deny. The act requires large employers to provide 12 weeks of unpaid leave when a child is born, fostered, or adopted. Terms also cover care for seriously ill family members. Conflict surrounds what are called rotational employees. Those are ferry staffers who work for 1 to 3 weeks straight, then take the same amount of time off. The federal complaint, filed Wednesday, says the ferry system counts such time as part of the 12-week leave required by federal law, and it says that is illegal. Corey Mills with the Alaska Department of Labor says the ferry system did nothing wrong.
The state continues to assert its longstanding interpretation of the Family Medical Leave Act and will continue to support that in the court action.
The complaint asks the court to make the state follow the Labor Department's interpretation of the rules, and it asks for lost pay and leave to be restored to any employee who lost it. The suit does not say how many employees have been affected or what jobs they held. Subsistence fishing takes different forms around the state and is governed by different laws. Though it's usually associated with areas far off the road system, some Alaskans rely on personal use fisheries, like dip netting, to fill their freezers. The fish is healthy and nutritious, but is it cost-effective as a solution to food insecurity? Ann Hillman, with the Solutions Desk, found out.
A On the shores of the Kosilov River, Bradley Fredrickson from Trapper Creek pushes his 5-foot-wide metal dip net into the water. He stands chest deep in the icy cold water, holding the end of the long metal pole.
So now you just wait?
That was nice.
He instantly catches a fish and heads back to shore with his net, ready to bonk the salmon on its head. 20-year-old Fredrickson, his parents, grandma, and siblings all know what it's like to be hungry.
There was winters where I had nothing but fish and potatoes and rice, and that was literally all that we ate all winter long, every meal.
Many summers, he's helped his family fill the freezer by sport fishing. He'd drive 20 to 30 miles round trip to local rivers, but he was limited to 3 fish per day. It took Fredrickson weeks to fill the freezer, and the fish weren't awesome.
It's good, but then the meat and the fish start to deteriorate because of the time and how long they're in the water.
The other adults in the house can't fish because of disabilities and looking after small children. So this year, Fredrickson decided to take a day off work from his construction job and join his friend for dip netting on the Kosilov.
And so your boss is totally cool with giving you time to come?
100%. He was like, good, do it all. He's like, go fill your freezer. I just did. And I was like, awesome. Like, I'm so excited now.
Does it pay off to miss work and drive more than 550 miles round trip just to get fish? His friend joins him on the beach and they start doing the math.
Oh, really?
650 a pound with the head on.
Okay.
So
they think they'll need to spend about $150 in gas total. They're camping on the beach for free, not spending a lot on food. They figure they'd only need to catch 5 salmon to make it worthwhile. In only a few hours, Fredrickson has already caught 8. His limit for his 6-person family is 75. They aren't the only ones doing the math. So are researchers at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, like Marilyn Kostick with the Subsistence Division.
And it economically makes sense and nutritionally makes sense for residents of the state to engage in subsistence activities. And that also includes urban residents as well.
She says you can't put a monetary value on the communal and cultural aspects of subsistence harvesting, but researchers do know that fishing pays off. And in some communities, people can use their food stamps to buy subsistence gear, like fishing nets, making it even more affordable, though the benefit is rarely used that way. In 2014, the most recently available data, Alaskans harvested nearly 46 million pounds of wild foods. That includes fish, game, and plants. In rural areas, that averaged out to about 275 pounds per person. In urban areas, it was only about 19. If all of that food was replaced by store-bought items at $6 a pound, it would cost more than $275 million. So is dip netting on the already crowded shores of local rivers the solution for statewide food insecurity in Alaska? Kostick says even though it can easily pay off, it's not for everyone.
You know, a lot of folks, they don't have time. They don't have the interest to go out and harvest their own fish, to go down and use the personal use fishery. But those fish are still being caught out there.
Alaska's commercial fisheries are pulling in nearly 99% of the state's wild-caught fish and game. Kostick says tapping into that
And making it readily available and easily accessible to residents, I think that really has the potential to bolster food security in the state.
But even if that happens, some residents, like Fredrickson, will still be hitting the shores, harvesting their freshly caught fish.
If you couldn't hunt and fish, would you have enough food in your household, you think?
Oh, no, not even close. Like, not even close.
Yeah.
Like, it would be bad.
So he keeps fishing. For the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And you can find more about the Solutions Desk on our website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, 4,000 miles. Last Friday, 70 cyclists completed the longest charity bicycle ride in the world, from Austin, Texas to Anchorage. Every year, the Texas 4,000 raises money for cancer research. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha was at the finish line to hear about how this annual journey is starting conversations about cancer all over the country.
Hundreds of people are lined up along a road at the University of Alaska Anchorage. They wave orange longhorn flags and shake cowbells. Yeah, that's right, symbols from the state's arch rival, Texas. They're anxiously awaiting the arrival of 70 bicyclists.
Do you have the hot coffee?
Yeah.
It's cold here. It's 105 in Texas.
Michelle Hauser stands in the crowd holding balloons and a sign for her daughter. It's been more than 2 months since her daughter set off on the 4,600-mile journey from Austin to Anchorage.
I just can't believe she made it. I was so concerned about them riding on the highways so long. And, you know, as a mom, you're like, is she eating enough? Is she drinking enough? Are they getting any sleep?
The Texas 4,000 was founded in 2004 by Chris Condit, an electrical engineering student at the University of Texas in Austin. Condit was diagnosed with cancer at age 11, but managed to beat the disease. He wanted to find a way to support people fighting cancer, so with help from other students, he founded the longest charity bike ride in the world. Most of the riders were not cyclists before getting involved with the Texas 4000. But Steve Cruz, the executive director of the organization, says that jumping into a challenging situation is what makes this experience meaningful.
Really, the bike ride is a metaphor for the fight against cancer. You don't know every day what you're going to face. You may get out on the road and there's extreme weather conditions and it's very difficult to get through, and you're relying upon other people to help pull you through.
Before setting off from Austin, each rider helps raise money to support cancer research and patient support services. This year, the organization has collected more than $700,000 for groups like MD Anderson Cancer Center and the Livestrong Foundation. Participants are then split into three teams, each with a separate route to Alaska. During the journey, teams ride up to 120 miles a day, sleeping at campsites or staying with hosts who volunteer to put them up. At towns along the way, they present donations to hospitals, speak with cancer patients, and give presentations on cancer awareness. The sound of sirens announces the arrival of the riders. After a fire truck and an ambulance roll by, the crowd goes wild as three teams pedal down the final stretch.
Oh my God, here they come!
At the finish line, the riders ditch their bikes and congratulate each other. Some laugh, some cry, everyone is exhausted. Each team gathers together for a celebratory chant before reuniting with friends and family. Many of the riders have personal connections to the disease. Jeff Conley, a junior at UT, decided to ride the Texas 4000 on behalf of his grandmother. She passed away from lung cancer the day they set out from Austin. But Conley was able to find strength with help from the people he met along the way.
Like the hosts we stay with, the people we meet, we're only with them for a day. And how much they can give us and how much they make this entire ride possible, it's tremendous, it's overwhelming. And just to kind of continue that generosity, pass it on to others, and continue fighting the good fight.
Eventually, Michelle Hauser finds her daughter Alaya in the crowd. Alaya says that over the summer, her team has practically become a second family for her.
We all learn how to love each other, and we're constantly trying to love each other well. And I think moving forward, I want to be able to love people in my life really well.
She says they go through a lot together. Along the road, there were many emotional conversations with people fighting cancer and others who had lost friends and family to the disease. Alaya is excited to be finished, but says she will be sad to leave her teammates.
Relationships like that in a community like that, where you live with the same people for that long, it's very hard to walk away from.
Although the ride may be over, she says the experience will stay with her for the rest of her life. For AK, I'm Henry Leisha.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from William Wilson in Wasilla. Wilson attended the opening of Fish Creek near Kinnick last month.
Look at a creek right now. It's crystal clear. I mean, you can see the fish.
I mean, that's the kind of rivers I go. I'll go up to a creek and I'll look in. Hey, there's a fish. I'm going to catch it. That's why I say I go catching. I don't go fishing. And I don't go to a creek that's muddy, milky, murky, or anything like that there. To me, that's a waste of time and a waste of effort. I will not go to a river or a creek that is, you got to catch it and then turn it loose. Ain't going to happen. If I catch something, it's going home. Yeah, I'm in it for the food. If you ever go into a grocery store and price a trout, I mean, a small, what, 8-10 inch trout, it's like 11, 12 bucks. Last year, I had to actually buy fish because all the creeks were flooded, and that was very disappointing. I did not like it. As I'm fishing and harvesting, I'll leave them in the water. I gut them and put them on stringers, leave them in the water, they stay fresh. You put them up in the back, you either draw flies or some kind of critter. A lot of folks will bring ice in an ice chest. I don't like work. Why am I gonna bring a cooler when I got the nets and then I got all the fish to pack? No, I put the fish in the nets and carry it over my shoulder and go. When I was a kid, we'd make our own dip nets out of homemade stuff and chicken wire. It worked. The chicken wire never collapsed, and whenever a fish went in, it stood straight up. If you like fishing, Alaska's a place to do it. I fish lower 48, you know, you catch catfish, burbot, sunfish, stuff like this. There ain't nothing better than trout and salmon.
William Wilson lives in Wasilla. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Henry Leisha, Ann Hillman, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Wesley Early, Ann Hillman, Johanna Urich, and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. 4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.